circles up and down the black. I'd ask him what the matter was, but I know that he don't talk. And the ladies treat me kindly, and they furnish me with tape. But deep inside my heart, I know I can't escape. Oh, mama, can this really be the end? To be stuck inside a mobile with the Memphis Blues again. Well, Shakespeare, he's in the alley with his pointed shoes and his bells, speaking to some French girl who says she knows me well. And I would send a message to find out if she's talked. But the post office has been stolen and the mailbox is locked. Oh, mama, can this really be the end? To be stuck inside a mobile with the Memphis Blues again. Mona tried to tell me to stay away from the train line. She said that all the railroad men just drink up your blood like wine. And I said, oh, I didn't know that. But then again, there's only one I've met, and he just smoked my eyelids and punched my cigarette. Oh, mama, can this really be the end? To be stuck inside a mobile with the Memphis Blues again. Grandpa died last week, and now he's buried in the rocks. But everybody still talks about how badly they were shocked. But me, I expected it to happen. I knew he'd lost control when I speed-built a fire on Main Street and shot it full of holes. Oh, mama, can this really be the end? To be stuck inside a mobile with the Memphis Blues again. Now the senator came down here showing everyone his gun, handing out free tickets to the wedding of his son. And me, I nearly got busted, and wouldn't it be my luck to get caught without a ticket and be discovered beneath the truck. Oh, mama, is this really the end? To be stuck inside a mobile with the Memphis Blues again. Now the tea preacher looked so baffled when I asked him why he dressed with 20 pounds of headlines stapled to his chest. But he cursed me when I proved to him. Then I whispered and said, not even you can hide. You see, you're just like me. I hope you're satisfied. Oh, mama, can this really be the end? To be stuck inside of Mobile with the Memphis Blues again. Now the rain man gave me two cures. Then he said, jump right in. The one was Texas medicine, the other was just railroad gin. And like a fool I mixed them, and it strangled up my mind. And now people just get uglier, and I have no sense of time. Mama, can this really be the end? To be stuck side of Mobile with the Memphis Blues again. When Ruthie says, come see her in her honky-tonk lagoon, where I can watch her waltz for free 'neath her Panamanian moon. And I say, oh, come on now, you know about my debutante. And she says, your debutante just knows what you need, but I know what you want. Oh, mama, can this really be the end? To be stuck inside of Mobile with the Memphis Blues again. Ah, the bricks lay on Grand Street where the neon madmen clam. They all fall there so perfectly, it all seems so well timed. And here I sit so patiently, waiting to find out what price you have to pay to get out of going through all these things twice. Mama, is this really the end? To be stuck here inside a Mobile with the Memphis Blues again.
CITR 101.9 FM. This is the Inkstead Show, the radio show where I talk. I always say I talk about comics, but I don't know if that's really the right term. I kind of talk to people about comics. Today's guest is Tim Lane. His book is Abandoned Cars, newly out from Fantagraphics Books. Well, not newly, I guess a couple of months now. Is that right?
Yeah.
That sound right? Okay. My mic sounds weird. Do I sound weird?
Yeah, you sound a little further away than when I first spoke to you.
Yeah, okay. When I first talked to you, I was on the phone, and now you're through a mixing board, and I'm on
a mic. I can hear you all right.
There we go. Okay. CITR 101.9 FM, The Ink Stud Show. That was Bob Dylan with the longest song title ever, Stuck Inside of Mobile with the Memphis Blues again.
Almost as long as the song.
It is a long song.
Yeah.
But it's from the classic Bob days.
It's a good one.
Off of Bob on Bob? Blonde on Blonde.
Blonde on
Blonde. Bob on Bob on Bob is the one from, was it Bob Roberts?
That one I don't know. I haven't heard that one.
It's the Tim Robin mockery where he plays like a total hyper-conservative politician who does all these folk albums, and they're all like rip-offs of Bob Dylan's. And
oh, really?
It's a fabulous movie. Fabulous. And he has one that's Bob on Bob.
And it's about, it's what, it's parodying Bob Dylan, or it's about?
It's parodying right-wing politicians.
Oh, okay.
But he like totally uses music. Now, I'm probably getting it way wrong because it's been about 10 years since I've watched it. But it's he like makes these like super conservative folk songs and things like that.
That works.
Yeah.
That works. In some universe, that works.
Yeah. Not ours. I don't think we'll be seeing
nope.
Sarah Palin singing any folk songs. Well, that would be interesting, though.
Yeah.
I guess.
Did you see the recent movie, I'm Not There?
Yes, I think so.
It's the one where they, I believe it's Todd Haynes who is the director. And he shows various points in Dylan's life through different actors.
Oh, no, I haven't actually watched it. I haven't watched it.
Very good. Very good. Worth seeing, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's got lots of fabulous actors.
If you're a
actors.
Bob Dylan fan, or if you're just a fan of film.
Well, what he had directed some really other fabulous movies. What was some other stuff by him?
I have no idea. That's the first I'd heard of him.
Because I think I've actually seen his other stuff, but not that one. So.
Well, it's worth it. It's definitely worth it, yeah. Whether you rent it or go buy the movie or, you know. Do you guys have Netflix up there?
I think we have that or a version of that.
Okay. Well, they send you the movies.
Yeah, and you send them back.
And, well, yeah, if you get the chance, that's a movie I'd recommend. I'm plugging a movie.
There we go.
Plugging a movie.
He did Velvet Goldmine. That's what I was trying to remember.
Hmm. And never heard of it. Was it pretty underground or what?
No. It was basically like the glam rock of the 70s in England with a kind of Bowie-esque character.
Right.
And Ewan McGregor playing Iggy Pop type character.
Sounds like a good movie.
Yeah. And he gets it on with Ewan McGregor and Christian Bale get it on in the movie.
You're kidding.
Nope.
Huh. Well, Christian Bale is in this one too, so apparently Todd Haynes is a fan of Christian Bale. He's getting a lot of recognition these days.
Just as long as he doesn't do that Batman voice anymore.
He didn't like it, huh?
I love the movie, but I really don't need to listen to constipated Batman.
Huh. Mm-hmm.
Enough Batman talk. Let's talk about you, Tim. Abandoned Cars is your book from Fantagraphics, and it's kind of, I guess, the best description that I can come up with. And my first thing reading is, like, it really has that feel of, like, kind of street-level 1950s, 1960s literature. And, like, in it, you go and say who your favorite writers are, and it's kind of like, bam. And
I can relate to the 1950s connection, but I've been a little surprised by the responses that I've gotten that involve the literature of that era. Are you talking about like detective literature, the kind of stuff that film noir came from, or what? When you say that, what do you mean?
Really, it's the big feeling I got was that was the Kerouac in it. Like,
okay.
That was a big
okay.
thing
well, then,
for me.
There we go.
It's that traveling, and it's just people's real stories, and that kind of gave me a little bit of Bukowski, not a lot because no one's as belligerent, but it's still that kind of seedy bar feeling that I get.
Sure.
Does that make sense? Not that I'm not trying to critique your work. Instead,
no, it's always really interesting to hear how people, you know, respond to it.
Mm-hmm.
How they take it, because I feel like I work pretty much in a vacuum, and you know, a lot of what's in Abandoned Cars has been racing through my head for years, and you know, you collect various influences and collect various things that, you know, attract you for whatever reason, and they just kind of, you know, they come together in however way they come together. So it's interesting to hear how other people respond to it, because that response may very well be quite different from the way I see it.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Well, I guess you're a bit of a cultural sponge in some aspects. I mean,
how do you
respectively.
Mean?
Just that your surroundings influence you.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And not just the surroundings, current surroundings, but also I'm very interested in history, and I'm very interested in particularly cultural history, and I guess what I sort of think of as a kind of mythology, particularly an American mythology that I think has the ghost or the echoes of which are, you know, just around every street corner, it seems, for me anyway. But then again, I guess I'm kind of looking for it too.
How long have you been doing comics for?
Geez. Well, I have been doing comics. I mean, I was, of course, like I suppose a lot of people, was very interested in comics when I was growing up. And I did comics, I dabbled with comics when I was very young. And then around the age of 17 or 18, I sort of started drifting away from it. But the influence was always there. I don't know why exactly I turned my, you know, turned away from it. But the influences were always there. And I guess I didn't really start doing comics proper until in my adult life, until I was in my early 20s. I started working on this story called Belligerent Piano, which I still am working on. But I don't know. That's it. I've been working on it since I was in my early 20s.
That's a great title.
You like that?
Yeah.
Thanks. I have no idea what it means, but I guess I like it too.
So, what was the choice to return to them and start making them?
Good question.
Because your work, it seems like you put a lot into it.
Yeah,
it's not just like, you know, here's a comic I did. It seems like it's well, very much planned out.
No, I'm very serious about it. I guess the best explanation for why I got back into comics, you know, for myself, it's been difficult to decide between whether I wanted to be a visual artist or whether or not I wanted to be a literary artist, and so I spent a lot of time exploring various ways of answering that question for myself. Everything from, you know, writing a book, just a strict literary book, to being more in the visual arts field, and then coming up with these a variety of hybrids. And I guess, you know, I'm talking about a period of time when I was in my 20s. I kind of see my 20s as being pretty formative. And exploratory. So I was, you know, messing around with various things. And at the same time, I was, for my own sake, I mentioned Belligerent Piano, and I was working on that almost as a way to defend myself against taking some of these things too seriously. You know, it was just one of my earliest influences in any way. Was Will Eisner's The Spirit. And so I wanted to kind of create a character that was not like Will Eisner's The Spirit, but that just gave for me that sense of satisfaction that The Spirit always gave me. And so, I mean, we could get into a conversation about Will Eisner and particularly The Spirit, but maybe we can, you know, come back to that later. The weird thing that happened was that despite my interest in trying to, you know, kind of defend myself about getting too serious in a visual arts or a literary arts sort of way, I got really serious about this Belligerent Piano thing, and it sort of became a hybrid where I was trying to employ more conventional literary approaches to conveying a narrative with then sort of playing with images as well. So you'd have parts that were long stretches of just straight narration and actually done in sort of a typewriter font so that it gave the impression of kind of like a, you know, Raymond Chandler or a Dashiell Hammett sort of hard-boiled detective mm-hmm. novel. And then come back to these visuals, panel-to-panel sequences, comics. And, you know, that's just... for me has continued in terms of just like this great thing that I can always go back to if I want to explore new territory. I kind of think of it as in terms of a narrative, although I have, you know, a long narrative for it, it tends to go vertical rather than horizontal. And what I mean by that is the ideas tend to go upward instead of forward. So it
builds on itself?
It builds on itself, exactly. Like, I ended up producing a sort of spoken word CD that enhances what I call the myth of Jack. And Jack is Jackie No Name, the main character of that story. He's sort of a wanderer, he's a vagabond. Freight train hopper, hitchhiker, that sort of thing. And it's set in the late 1940s, which is one of my favorite periods of American history. And so with that myth, you know, I've created booklets that are meant to enhance the myth of Jack, and the spoken word CD, which is, you know, kind of like a play on old 1940s radio dramas, but very loosely. And so, it's really become, you know, a vehicle for exploration more than it has like a straight ahead, you know, comic that was meant to pacify any kind of taking things, you know, too seriously. Did that make sense?
Yeah. Well, there's one thing I noticed when reading the book in, like, in the chronological order, even though, or not chronological, the whichever order the book is in.
Which book now?
The whole Abandoned Cars book. Reading that, is it seems the different components you slice in there, it seems very multifaceted, like things have different functions that they're playing with each other within the larger narrative of it. Did that make sense?
Could you give me a specific example, the
prose pieces with the descriptive picture.
Oh, right.
The intersplicing, the radio play work like that.
Radio play.
Well, not radio play, but the guy listening or yourself listening to Art Bell.
Ah, okay. That's not me.
No.
Incidentally.
Okay.
The only character who is me in this story is the character in Spirit, the freight hopping one.
The autobiographical
adventure.
And I was
really reluctant about doing an autobiographical story because, yeah, you know, it's a bit of a strange thing, I think, when you try to start. Excuse me. When you start trying to include yourself as a character in a story, because for myself, I feel most comfortable writing stories kind of behind the veneer of somebody else.
Yeah,
it's easier, I think, to be totally honest with myself and I suppose anybody who cares to read it. If which is, you know, kind of an irony there, because for me the way to be honest is to to lie somewhat and to, you know, put myself out there as somebody else. Not that each character is, you know, I'm masking myself behind each character, but these characters are all people I've known, and I think that the only kind of character I could really write, you know, even a little bit well about would be a character who I identify with. So they all have aspects about them that I can identify with. Well, and those sort of things tend to glue the stories together into a package as a whole.
That's kind of like...
Because there are overarching themes that are sometimes conscious, sometimes not, but that glue the stories together into a volume, I think.
Well,
into something coherent.
That's like a classical piece of American literature, I think, is that mask of not autobio, but self referencing.
Well, explain what you mean a little bit more by that.
Well, like look at someone like, going back to Kerouac, where, you know, he's writing about his life, but it's all not to the book, and, you know, everyone has different names.
Sure, sure.
And like, because,
but, you know, he always had intended that at the end of his life, he was going to create like a complete set, Vanity of Deleuze, this sort of complete set where everybody's names would be finally changed to their correct real life names. I believe it was a ploy by the editors to change locations and to change names. I'm not sure. I'd have to go back and double check about that. He may not have wanted to include everybody's names accurately for other reasons at the time, but I know that he had eventually intended to go back and change everybody's names to what they actually were. And you know, like books like The Subterranean. I believe it was the decision of the publisher to set that on the West Coast rather than on the East Coast where it had actually happened. So that's kind of a funny thing, and I think Kerouac is kind of a, you know, he's a loaded writer. There's a lot to talk about in terms of a guy like him. But I believe he was very much always front and center. At least maybe that's because that's the way, you know, by the time I read Kerouac, it was already, the late 1980s. So Kerouac had been pretty well digested into the...
milieu?
Pardon me?
The milieu...
Yeah, and had been commercialized to a certain degree. So separating myth from truth with a guy like Kerouac is not always so easy.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I think, you know, he was, at least when I was growing up reading him, I was like, you know, this guy's extraordinary, you know, with books like On the Road. And I never separated him from the persona in his books, which, you know, may or may not have been, true, or the right way to read his books, or the right way to read anybody's books. But I couldn't help doing that, you know. And to this day, I still feel the same way about Kerouac. I don't read him as much as I used to. He's very much a young man's writer,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I'll never forget the influence and the way he inspired my life.
The rush that On the Road brings on.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, and you know, he does what I think what all my favorite writers do, and that is to present a world that is something that's, you know, true and then not true, and, you know, but you believe it. And I think to a large degree it probably wasn't true. And what I mean by that is, like, so much of it's subjective. You know, we're looking at Kerouac's world through Kerouac's eyes, and I have a good friend who describes Kerouac as the last great oh wow writer. You know, like, oh wow, look at the sunset, oh wow, look at the passing freight train, oh wow, everything's oh wow. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And when you're a young man, you know, I'm saying, like, you know, just getting out of high school and college, at least for me, that's how I felt. You know,
it's
wow,
not...
there's so much you can go out and do. Wow, there's a whole world, you know. And he kind of was calling, I suppose, myself and anybody who was a fan of his to go live. And, you know.
It's that sense of awe and wonderment.
Exactly. And if once you're there, you don't find what Kerouac saw, it's not his fault, you know. You find what you find,
yeah.
You know, and that's your story.
Yeah.
So I've always looked at people like Kerouac as it's kind of like I mentioned it in the story Spirit, that it was, you know, he was one of a few writers who was like a big brother, who was out there sending me these telegrams with postcards with these, you know, you've got to come see this sort of, they're like very, very long postcards.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, he didn't do me wrong by sending me those postcards. I went and looked for it myself, and I didn't know the world did it, but I'm glad I went and did it.
Your cell phone's just breaking up there a little.
It is.
I'm going to do a quick song break, though, in case
okay.
You're like in a hallway or something. And I'm going to play Mystery Train. Since we're talking about your spirit story.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Great, great.
That seems apropos. So we'll be right back. Ink Stud, CITR 101.9, and we're talking to Tim Lane.
Train I ride 16 coaches long. Long. Well, that long black train got my baby and gone. Train, train, coming round, round the bend. Train, train, coming round the bend. Well, it took my baby, but it never will again. No, not again. Train, train, coming down the line. Train, train, coming down the line. Well, it's bringing my baby, 'cause she's my all mine, she's my all mine. Train, train. Round the bend. still my baby, but it never will again. Never will again.
CITR 101.9 FM. This is the Inkstead Show, the radio show where we talk about comics. And today's guest is Tim Lane. How you doing, Tim?
Good, good.
Good. We're just listening to a little classic Elvis there.
Indeed.
I like that era, that, you know.
Oh, yeah. The Hillbilly Cat.
The Hillbilly Cat. It's good, good times indeed. So, tell me about some adventures you've had traveling.
Oh, jeez.
Plenty?
Just like start anywhere.
Anywhere. It's your story.
Well, one thing that I always noticed, and I don't travel as much as I used to. One thing I always notice is that you, no matter where you are, it seems like you run into some Australians. Australians and Brits. There are a lot of them around, it seems, traveling around. And if you do run into them, personally speaking, my experience has been you are in for a good time. Because particularly with Australians, I don't know what it is, but every time I run into Australians when I was traveling, they're just always up for a good time. I remember I had moved to the Bay Area. I had $500 and I bought a one-way ticket on a bus. And I had it in mind that I was going to be able to, with $500, find an apartment and set myself up in San Francisco. And, oh man, this is a bit of a convoluted story. It's got like stories within stories. But, when I got out there, I had a friend who was going to let me stay with him for a while, but it turned out that he had to leave. He was living on Florida Street in the Mission, and he had to leave because his landlord had determined somehow that he was having an affair with the landlord's girlfriend. So this landlord apparently was a bit off his rocker, and was either threatening to do him bodily harm or worse. And so he decided that, you know, sorry, Tim, I'm on my way to Oregon. I'm going to do some fly fishing. You can come along if you want, but you're not going to be able to stay with me at this apartment because I have to, you know, I have to make myself scarce. So I was kind of out of luck, and I ended up staying at a variety of places, all of which have their kind of stories in between. But to get back to the Australian thing, I ended up staying at this hostel in Sausalito and just living out of my backpack at the time. And so nothing was established. Nothing was going right. And so my answer to those sorts of circumstances at the time was to go find a place where I could get a beer and you know, shoot a game of pool. And so I was in Sausalito, and I think I had just looked at a houseboat. There were some houseboats that were for rent, and I was thinking at the time that I was going to rent a houseboat. And I was there thinking it over and playing pool. This guy had shown me was like going for $200. And it would have been, I didn't end up doing it. It would have been a lousy, lousy thing because apparently if you sleep in those boats, nothing ever gets dry. And so you will be constantly in this state of dampness.
Mold, mildew.
Yeah, exactly. So, things weren't looking really good. And I wasn't sure what I was going to do. And so I ran into these Australians who were on the last leg of a nationwide trip they were taking. They had started on the East Coast. One of the guys was a mechanic. So they had bought a car on the East Coast and had driven all the way to the West Coast, and they were kind of like on the tail end of their trip. Now, with all the stories that I have, and with this one in particular, I am only relating to you what these guys told me. whether it was entirely honest or not, I don't know, and to a large degree, I don't particularly care, so long as the story's relatively good. And so, it doesn't do me any harm. But that was their story, that they had made it across the country in this fashion. And so we ended up, it just kind of ended up one of these, everything where everything goes sideways, and you can vaguely remember, everything that happened. But what I do remember is finishing the night off, we were peeing off the Golden Gate Bridge. And this was like, this was the thing that they wanted to do as sort of like a hurrah, we made it to the West Coast kind of thing.
Yeah.
So that was pretty interesting. Further on, though, and incidentally, I never did see them again. We didn't, this has been one of my problems over the years, is that I rarely keep in touch with some of these characters who I have met, and I've learned to really regret mm-hmm. that I didn't. But then again, I mean, that was just like, I don't know, that was just a night sort of thing, and how close do you stay in touch with people like that?
One crazy
evening. So that story goes, it follows, it has more interesting things that happen. So I'm there in the Bay Area, and I still, don't have any place to stay. I'm staying at this hostel, and my money's running short. So for whatever reason, I was taking the BART to Oakland. I was going through Oakland. I mean, I eventually did end up living in Oakland. But I was kind of trying to find places in Oakland, and I knew that the West Oakland Freight Yard was supposed to be a pretty interesting place to see. So I made my way down there, and I went into a place called the Clam Bar, I think it was. And I started talking to the bartender and, telling her my story. And there was a guy at the other end of the bar, this guy wearing a leather jacket, and he had a ponytail. And he was about my age at the time, so it was like 24, 25. And he came up and he was like, hey, I overheard that conversation, and we just happened to have a place for rent. One of our roommates moved out, and you could move into that place for, I think it was $250 a month. And so I was like, okay, great. And so that was that. But, I couldn't move in right away. I had like a week before I could move in. So we finished the night off and got to know each other a little bit. And as it turned out, he turned out to be a really cool guy. Very interesting story, too. His father was British, and his mother was from Thailand, I believe. So he had a really interesting mix, but he was very, very much into Americana. He had a customized 1948 Harley Davidson. And, I mean, he was just, the leather jacket, the boots. He was living, Marlon Brando in The Wild One. But he was a, really cool guy. Anyhow, so I had a week left before I could move in. And as we were leaving the bar, a freight train was rolling through the West Oakland yards, and you could just vaguely see it. And I was like, I started telling him that I was, I liked hopping freight trains at the time. I was more into it. And we made some kind of bet. Like, he's like, no, you're not. And I said, well, I'll bet you I am. And I think it turned out to be like, I don't know what, like, we bet. I said, I'll bet you whatever you've got in your pocket that I'll jump that train right now. And, we'd been drinking, so this was not the smartest thing to do. And I, wouldn't recommend it to anybody. And if I ever have children, they'll never hear this story. But eventually I did. He gave me, I think he had like $20 in his pocket. And I ran through the yard. I can remember running right underneath the searchlight. They've got these, very powerful lights in these freight yards. And the tower where the guys are monitoring the whole freight yard, this was the dumbest thing to do if you're interested in getting anywhere on a freight train. But I ran right underneath them, got into one of the cars. Now, they were box cars, and they were open, which should have been a sign right there, because my understanding is today, rarely are box cars ever open, for the reasons of, they don't want anybody hopping in the freight cars. But this one is open, so I thought, jumped in. It was going northward, so I thought, maybe I'll just end up running into my friend up in Oregon. But it ended up going into the hole, which is a term for it. Just, you know, it's where they put the cars to sleep. It's, you know, some place 5 miles outside of the center part of the freight yard, and slept out there in a very cold boxcar.
Oh.
No, is that a story? Is that
no excitement for you?
Merit any points is a good story.
It's a good story.
It's definitely one that shows just how ridiculously dumb I am.
So, how far have you been able to get boxcar jumping?
Never very far. I've never, you know, I wouldn't call myself by any stretch of the imagination a true freight train hopper. You know, a couple of states at the most. It's just, frankly, I don't think I've got the whatever it takes to be one of those people who does take long distance trips. There's a book out called Riding Toward Everywhere by William T. Volman. Are you familiar with him?
Mm-hmm. No, I'm not.
Okay. Well, I recently read his book, and it just, you know, put to shame any kind of experience I've had with it. But then on the other hand, I've never had anybody with me, or I've never known anybody. This is kind of an interesting thing, too. I've never run into anybody while I was doing it. And I think if you were really going to become serious about that kind of business, you should start with somebody who knows something about it. So, yeah, I'll show you the ropes a little bit.
The old hobo that shows you the way.
Yeah, right, exactly. And, you know, another thing about including that story, which I think is, you know, it's the one thing that I found sort of interesting about writing an autobiographical story is that it sort of shows you things as you write it, and then after you write it, you read it, and certain epiphanies tend to show up. And one of those was that this is, for me anyway, and I think this very well fits into the theme of the book, freight train hopping is not really a viable thing to do anymore. I mean, there are so many ways to get hurt. I mean, not that there haven't always been, but things that, because of modern technology, because of the way the railroad works now, I think it makes for freight train hopping in the old world sort of way, you know, the hobo sort of myth that we've become conscious of through Woody Guthrie and through folk music and all of that.
And The Simpsons.
It doesn't exist so much today.
No.
I find anyway.
Well, I used to work with street kids, and a lot would actually do train hopping. They'd actually show me like their schedules and stuff of the freight trains and things. Quite organized.
Say once again? I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
I used to work with street kids in downtown Vancouver, and some of them would be train hoppers, and they'd show me their complicated schedules that they'd have for what freight trains are going where, what the best spots were and stuff.
Right.
Because in Canada, you don't want to end up on the one that stops in Winnipeg in the middle of the winter.
Absolutely. It was Jack London who wrote quite a bit about the freight train hopping experience through Canada. It sounds, of course, that was, you know, a century ago, but but that's also true in the United States. You can jump on somewhere, and it's, you know,
end up in 85, Minnesota.
90 degrees and wake up and it's below freezing. It can be very, very dangerous. And so, I don't know if, you know, that might be somewhat of an exaggeration, but you can change your circumstances extremely fast without being, without protecting yourself or being conscientious of the changes.
Well, that's very true. In Vancouver, we're quite a mild climate, and Calgary's 12 hours away.
Mm-hmm.
Which is the complete opposite. It's, you know, extreme cold and no fun for people.
Well, these kids, do they travel together or they travel alone?
Some travel together, some alone, some with dogs. You know, different, whatever works for them. A lot of kids come out from Quebec because, Quebec, if you're out in the streets in the winter, you're going to die. Mm-hmm. And Vancouver, I mean, it's so mild, and this is where you want to be in the winter. So,
yeah, dangerous business. Definitely dangerous business. My attraction to it was, well, probably because I had been somehow. I don't know if it's just in your DNA if you're born in the United States or not, but it is a part of that myth that you grow up. I don't know. You just somehow you know about it. You know the story without actually knowing exactly how you learned about the story. And so I was always really attracted to that story. That's sort of the myth of the hobo. And I think there's also something that I relate to. I can relate to about that kind of personality. And it's not, you know, it's not necessarily, it's not always easy to make tangible connections between that relatedness. But it's there. It's there somehow. So I wanted to experience it. And again, you know, it wasn't at all what I thought that it was going to be like. But on the other hand, I am very glad that I did it. And, you know, I learned what it's like through my experience rather than learning about it through the experiences of others.
Totally. I just, one of the things in there going along with the American legend is you do the strip about Stag Lee.
Mm-hmm.
And what was the choice of researching him and making him a subject?
Well, because I used to do a weekly column for a weekly paper here called the Riverfront Times, and I stopped doing it. I do it once a month now, but at the time I was doing it on a weekly basis, and I wanted to take that story has its origins in this city. I live in St. Louis, so it has its origins in St. Louis, and what I like so much about St. Louis is that, you know, the longer you live here, the more you find out that some of this folklore that is nationally known or internationally known occasionally has its origins in this city. So I wanted to do that story based for those reasons. And coupled with that, I wanted to... the You Are Here columns are rarely comic strips.
Mm-hmm.
But that one I wanted to run as, you know, as close to kind of like an old-fashioned, you know, Dick Tracy or Steve Canyon sort of daily drama. You know how they used to run you know, these comics as weeklies or dailies? Yeah. At the time it was dailies.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to serialize it in that fashion. Now, you know, if you look at it, it doesn't really look like that. But it was as close as I could get with the format that I was working in for that paper to tell that Stagger Lee story with the relationship to the Dick Tracy and the old-time newspaper dailies. So, you know, I had produced this whole story, and after I'd finished it, I included it. I decided to include it in the book because I felt that it, too, had relevance to the whole kind of mythology or the American mythological drama that I thought glued these other stories together. But I do include it as sort of a separate piece. It's an add-on. It's not meant to be a part of mm-hmm. the essential bulk of the story.
Is there something about living in St. Louis? Because I didn't realize it. Like you mentioned, you live in St. Louis. There's also Dan Zetwalk.
Yeah.
He's also a St. Louis guy.
There's a lot of them.
And he has that son.
Ed May lives here. There's Kevin, I do not know how to pronounce his last name.
Huizenga.
Yes. He lives here. You've interviewed Matt Kind.
Yes.
He lives here. You know, I didn't know that these guys lived here, and I don't know them very well. I actually just met Kevin at the recent book signing here at one of the independent bookstores. But he seems like a really cool guy. And Dan's a really cool guy, and Ted's, you know, I've met him too. They're all, you know, they seem like great guys.
But
they, you know, they're the USS Catastrophe Group.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's a strange thing because it's like there's an awareness that they produce comics and that you have that mutual interest. But I don't, like I say, I don't know a lot of other cartoonists, and I'm not even sure I call myself a cartoonist. And I think, you know, if I don't know how many of many cartoonists are all that connected. I mean, there are famous examples like, was it Seth and Joe Mott? Is it Mott or Matt?
Matt.
Joe Mott.
Joe Matt, and Chester Brown. I mean, these guys are friends.
Yeah.
You see it in their work.
Well, I don't mean that. I'm not talking about friendship necessarily. It's just that I guess it's like a Midwestern.
I don't know. I don't concept. Know. Like, I just, don't know if those guys grew up here or if they moved here like I did. I know that I moved here because there's a neighborhood here that I really like. And I knew I was living in New York City before I moved here. And I just knew that if I wanted to take comics as seriously as I wanted to, I was going to have to go somewhere that was cheaper because I was just working illustration jobs just to stay, you know, keep mm-hmm. my head above water. And that's not very conducive to being able to, for me anyway, it wasn't conducive to be able to being able to really concentrate on the book.
Well, you're not going to get a book done.
Yeah. I mean, lots of people do. Lots of people do. I don't know how they do it, but a lot of people do.
They all move to Portland.
Yeah. Right. No, I mean New Yorkers, Deitch, you know. But again, you know, these guys, or Glenn Head, you know, these guys are, I don't think they've ever been anywhere. Well, Kim has, but, you know, there's a lot of guys who have been there, I think, all along.
Yeah.
But when you take into account someone like Kim Deitch, I think that he also, he might, because of how, you know, he's been around for a while, he's also experienced. What I guess I'm getting at is it might have been easier to live on the Lower East Side when he was, you know, in the kind of the same position I would have been in, say, 2000,
yeah,
than it was for me to be there in 2000. Am I articulating that clearly?
I don't know if I got it.
You don't know if you got it? I'm just saying that there might have been times when it was easier or cheaper to live in New York than when I was there.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's the one story of when he was roommates with Spain and he had to carry a gun in his pocket to leave his building.
Say that again?
When Kim and Spain Rodriguez were roommates back in the 60s when they were working on the East Village, they lived in this really crappy building where Kim would leave the apartment with a gun in his pocket just in case anything happened on his way out the door.
I've heard stories about that area. Like around what time would this have been?
This
late 60s, early 70s?
67.
Yeah. I met a close friend when I was living in New York the last time who had been around and lived in the Lower East Side, at that time. And he had extraordinary stories about what life was like there at that time.
What do we have to look forward from you in the future?
Well, I'm trying to produce, this is just the first of three books that are similar in nature in terms of being graphic short stories and dealing with this great American mythological drama, or what I'm calling that. So I'm working on those two books. I've got a lot of ideas for various things in mind. There's a graphic novel that I want to produce, and I've never really given up on that notion of creating some sort of hybrid piece that's a combination of just maybe a little more exploratory or just something different than a conventional graphic novel or a book of graphic short stories. I'm not quite sure what that's going to be yet, but it's always been a desire of mine to do.
I say do it. Push the envelope.
Yeah. I'd like to. Absolutely. We're just going to have to see how things go. It's difficult, you know, having interviewed a lot of cartoonists, I'm sure that you've heard over and over again about how time-consuming the work is.
It is. I couldn't imagine how much work people put in to a book, and like something like this is what, 150, 160, 70 pages?
Yeah, it's about 168 pages. It's not so easy to... I find as I get older, I'm 38, I just turned 38, and I find that I am less inclined to not prioritize as I used to be, whereas now I'm thinking, okay, so how many of these can I feasibly get done?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm hoping that, you know, somewhere along the line it gets so that I don't have to do as much like freelance illustration work or that sort of thing to pay the bills, but you know, who's to say how that, how can you ever count on that sort of thing happening? But if you could just be able to focus all of your time and attention on these stories and these books, that would be wonderful. It would still take a lot of time. You know what I mean?
Well, and I've heard that from other folks, like Seth. He, I think, plans out different projects well in advance because it takes so much work, and he does a lot of freelance stuff. I mean, he doesn't really advertise that, but he does
it.
I mean, Bullard's got to make money.
It's extremely time consuming. I mean, it's extremely rewarding, but it's time consuming. And one thing that I've always wanted to do is produce stories in a comic, like an old fashioned comic book, what they call pamphlets now.
A comic? One of those?
Yeah, I know. Calling them pamphlets always just feels really strange.
You'll never hear me say it.
They've always just been comics. But I understand, you know, from an industry's point of view, it could get confusing. You know, graphic novels, comics, it all starts, you know, meshing together.
They all got words and pictures.
Pardon?
They all have words and pictures.
Yeah,
that's all that matters to me.
But no, I'd like to produce. I was producing something called Happy Hour in America, in which installments of Belligerent Piano, as well as short stories for Abandoned Cars, was running. But I was self-publishing it, and you know, I don't know what it takes to get that sort of thing out there and get exposed, and so that people know what the hell it is. I had a really hard time with that. You know, nobody's heard of you know, Happy Hour in America except for a few people. So how do you go about doing that? My understanding is that the industry right now is really not catering toward those sorts of pamphlets anymore.
Well, it depends. It's kind of a
tragedy in a way, because part of the thing about comics, I think, that is endearing is that history. Is the history that it has, you know, the cheap paper, the on the rack sort of appeal,
the disposable
and
media.
For me, I mean, I guess one to answer a question you asked earlier about why comics for me, in terms of these short stories, is because I think comics is very much a part of that mythology that I'm getting across. So why not speak these stories in the language of, you know, the language of that myth itself, right?
Yeah.
It seems to me that if you're going to tell American stories or stories that involve this American mythology, why not do it through pop culture avenues? The Stagger Lee story comes to us through music, everything from folk and blues into eventually pop music. That's part of the mythology too. You know, there's just something. Mm-hmm. There's something that really resonates for me about that. And so, you know, in comics fits into that. Another thing that's a real tragedy for me is that those old serials, those dailies like Dick Tracy and like Steve Canyon, I don't know where those are anymore either.
They're Family Circus.
Pardon me?
They're Family Circus.
Yeah, right. And nothing against that kind of thing, but I miss that. You know, that's a part of comics history that I think would be a real tragedy to see just let go, because it's not something that the industry is supporting anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
I do.
There are some of these things that it seems like they're just worth holding on to for the sake of their value beyond the marketplace.
On that note, I have to cut us off. It's the hour has ended. Thankfully, there are plenty of opportunities to pick up some of those strips nowadays because folks are reprinting them. But thank you so much for joining
us
today, Tim.
Absolutely. Thanks for the opportunity.
Sorry to have to cut you off. The other guys are here with their record players and stuff in tow.
No, that's all right. That's all right. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you.
It was great to have you on. Any song I should end off with?
How about the Tom Waits song?
Sounds good.
Okay.
We should play that.
All
and
right,
take care. Thanks.
Bye.
That was Tim Lane. And up next, Crimes and Treasons. Next week, I'll be talking to Rick Veach, folks. Y'all later.
sign up in our town. If you live it up, you won't live it down. So she left Monte Rio, son, just like a bullet leaves a gun.